The group here is over 435, resist. 440, 445, 446. The group here is now over 445, 446, 445. Right down 445. 445.
Mark's going to make an announcement. And then
oh.
Sit down and just wait.
The group here is 445. We're starting at 445 is the calibration of the group. I guess I'm on. It's on, right? It's on. Today we're speaking on no mind. What there is to say about it, I can't think of. No. No mind. Yeah, she was pinning me up with all these things. I thought, the best way to become a good Christian is to be a Buddhist. Yeah. There's a wonderful Buddhist community here and a wonderful Christian community. And the way to become a good Buddhist is to be a good Christian and vice versa, because the essence of truth remains the same throughout the ages. And the novelty of the lectures we give is that a means of ascertaining truth, which was not before available, became available, and we then had a way of going back over spiritual and religious history throughout all of time and reaffirming and discovering and clarifying many things. So the books that we've been writing have to do with clarification, because spiritual reality is difficult to comprehend by the mind. And what's been written about it over the centuries has sometimes been misleading. Plus, there is a great deal that is erroneous in what is considered to be spiritual literature. And we recommend that exercise where you go through your spiritual library. And everything that makes you go strong, you put in one pile. Everything that makes you go weak, you put in another pile. And it's quite an amazing discovery. Sort of weed out the poppycock. And what's the reason for that? It's because the mind just loves things that are mysterious, magical, occult, and sounding. And we get trapped by that, the intrigue of the magical and confusing the magical with the miraculous. Two different realms. So today we're really going to summarize what we've said so far. The series of lectures has really been preparatory to become acquainted with the nature of the ego, and therefore to disassemble it. And we started out to do so the very first lecture, which we repeat every time. I want you to become aware that everything is happening spontaneously of its own. Everything here is spontaneously becoming what it is, and is not being caused by anything. There is no cause within reality. The subject of non-duality, which has to do with no mind, the most basic understanding, and it's the reason it was the very first thing we spoke of, is the realization that causality itself is an illusion, because the entire ego is based on the notion of causality. To transcend the notion of causality actually is quite a high comprehension to transcend causality. Now, we asked about that one time, the transcendence of causality. We have permission to ask this resist. He's over 996, 997, 998, 999. Wow. So that would make it a little difficult, wouldn't it? Yes. The ego is based on the concept that everything is being caused by something else, and that nothing really can exist, therefore, as it is, without being caused by something else. So we repeat this each time, because to merely hear this, to merely know it, begins to undo its power. Because creation, that which is, manifests by virtue of the grace, by virtue of the grace of its source, which is the Creator. The unmanifest, becoming manifest, is creation itself, the source of every of all existence. There's only one power in the universe sufficiently powerful to account for existence itself. Each of us comes in thinking, well, I came into this world due to the genes of my parents, and because of the whole long sequence of genes is how we account for our present existence of the human race. As you were, creation is continuous. By grace, each instant, everything is becoming the fulfillment of its infinite of its potential. Everything is manifesting the power of creation by virtue of its source. To acknowledge God as the source of one's existence is a very, very powerful statement, and already takes consciousness leaps ahead. It's the source of power of the United States Constitution, which calibrates at 700, the highest in the world, by virtue of the divinity of our Creator. Out of that comes all rights of our citizens. Not by vote, not by the power of politics, not by armed might, not by the force of a dictator, but by virtue of the divinity of our Creator. That puts it at 700. Consequently, to try to remove that acknowledgement is not really in the service of one's own spiritual advancement or that of others. Which brings us to one of the great difficulties of mind, and that is, you understand that mind works on content within a certain context. So we can shorten this whole trip of transcending mind, which we've tried to do throughout all these lectures, by disassembling it. And then we finally get to the core of something we can address. We all do letting go, we all do surrendering, we all try to become non-attached to the world, let go of aversions and attractions. And this is sort of continuous. It's also sort of a continuous meditation. It's really a contemplation. And there's a borderline between contemplation and meditation, in which you go about through the day with a certain equanimity, because as each thing comes up, you let it go. As it comes up, you let it go. As it comes up, you let it go. And just as we were leaving this morning, the kitty was missing. Ready to go, and the kitty's missing. The screen is up. Where is Kitty? Oh, God. So it's interesting what the mind does at that moment, you know. It instantly detached from this kitty. All kitties are kittiness, and let go for kittiness will represent itself. And so I said to Susan, I affirm the positive, not that he's lost, but kitty always returns. Kitty always returns, which is a fact. And so she called Brock and said, "Kitty's missing." So Brock went, he lives right near us. Brock went to his front door and the kitty walked in. I mean, is there a problem? What is the problem? Kitty had no problem, sat down and purred, and it's fine. Everything that presents itself to mind, every little tool in the mind, every mechanism of the mind, we're dealing with content within context. To see all things as content within usually an unstated context is one way to quickly transcend mind. Mind focuses on content. The content is a statement, a fact, kitty is missing, whatever. The content then triggers all kinds of emotional reactions, as you can see. How can we go without a kitty? I mean, what might happen to kitty? The dog might get kitty. The raccoon might get kitty. I went outside, sure enough, there's a big raccoon out there. Skunks all over the place. Coyotes who will eat kitties. Dogs, I mean, what are we living in, a zoo here? What is this? Wildlife zoo. All right. So the only thing you can do is surrender kitty, who is the content, to God, who is the infinite context. And you formalize it by asking the Holy Spirit to find kitty. The Holy Spirit was pretty quick this morning, a couple of minutes. Constantly dissolving content into context. All right. You'll see that almost all human error, 90% of human error, is the failure to define context. Every night on TV we see, you know, rather shocking examples of literally looking at content and completely ignoring context. Because the truth of content depends completely on context. In fact, without context, content has no meaning at all. So, last night on television, there was some woman who was abysmally abused in the airport going through the examination line. And night after night, there's some poor creature there who's had her wooden leg removed and stripped naked, and night after night there's an atrocity. Atrocities are committed by these people who check you out at the count of the check-in counter. Totally missing the whole point, isn't it? I mean, the total missing of the intention of the whole thing is so drastic. If you're looking for black people, you don't stop all the white people on the street, do you? If you're looking for white people, you don't stop all the black people on the street. If you're looking for men, you don't stop all the women, do you? And so we see an absurdity, where the context is totally lost. That people should not be harassed because of their race is the intention. And then its application becomes the opposite, becomes an absurdity, you see? Oh, Lord. And so context transforms everything. When the fire danger is high, which it was at the last lecture, fire danger, we had huge fires all over Arizona, you're not allowed to go camping. Not allowed to go camping. You can say, well, it's my right, I pay taxes, I have a right to camp. But the context has changed. Extreme fire danger. So I just cite them as examples we can see every night on television, where ignoring context, you see the absurdity of what would otherwise be sensible content. Nobody argues that people should not be discriminated against by virtue of race, culture, or whatever. And then what happens to that truth? That truth then becomes actually its opposite. It actually becomes its opposite. I think these people at the check-in counter are on a combined program to destroy this thing because it's so absurd. So they take it to the other extreme to try and get it overturned because, you know, stopping every little old lady who has a steel pin in her hip is not the way to find whatever those Al-Qaeda's or whatever those people are. It's not the way to find them, actually. And mathematically, it was discovered that the chances are diminished by 6,000 to 1 by following our current check-in style. Diminishes its effectiveness by 6,000%. So that if we stopped all that, our chances of finding a real shoe bomber would be 6,000 times higher. The whole thing is absurd, is it not? Can you imagine a shoe bomber, and he's going to go to heaven and taking all these innocent people with him? The way you get to heaven is you wear bombs in your shoes and you blow up all kinds of innocent people, and there's people that buy this as truth. So the extent to which truth becomes mangled when content is taken out of context, it's possible, and of course it's a big problem in our current society, maybe for 50 million years or 40 million years or whatever, because Homo sapien is really a transitional life form. Homo sapien is transitional. We like to look at Homo sapien as the crowning glory of evolution, above the monkeys and all those things below us, you see. And now modern man, in our own fantasy, modern man is the most advanced creature that could be, really. We'll soon be going to the moon. No, we went to the moon. We'll still be going to Mars. No, we're going to Jupiter. So we're going someplace, always, to show the advancing superiority of the human race. Huh? Let's see, if what do we call current man? Homo sapien, right? Homo sapien? Yeah? Homo sapien. We have permission to ask this, resist. Homo sapien is a transitory genus, resist. Transitory. We're not permanent. Neanderthal man wasn't permanent. Cro-Magnon man wasn't permanent. Homo erectus ante Australopithecus. Is that right? All those folks back there. Yeah. Cousins. All those cousins back there were transitory. And we are transitory. This couldn't possibly be the ultimate possibility of evolution. Absurdity, what you watch on TV every night, strip searching a little old lady with a steel pin in her hip. That can't possibly be the ultimate evolution of consciousness. Huh? I'm glad we got the answer we got. What if we'd gotten, this is it, folks? Oh, wow. So how far can you go with an animal body? I mean, you've got an animal body and you've got this consciousness. I mean, how much farther can you go with it? You know, you've got the Olympics to see how far you can strain it. What can you get out of this combination of things here? I've lost interest in eating years ago or any other activity that it does. It entertains me. And without it, my wife would be forlorn. And so I say, well, keep it. Because without it, she'd say, where are you? People get attached to the body, so it's inevitable. It's part of the animal nature to be attached to the body. So we trace the evolution of consciousness from its origination up through the evolution of life forms on the planet. And in the book I, there's a dazzling chapter on it. Dazzling chapter. tracking the evolution of the energy of life as it evolves over millennia, over hundreds of millions of years. And of course, as it does, it goes up through the animal kingdom. And as it goes through the animal kingdom, and we have a physical brain with all kinds of animal parts in it, which still fire off unasked. And so where evolution takes us. The animal has evolved to the point where it can think, and now it's becoming spiritually conscious. And that we marked the late 1980s when the consciousness level of mankind went over 200 for the first time. In the book I said that marks the appearance of a new genus, Homo spiritus. Let's see if that's a fact or my fantasy. It could be my fantasy. that is a fact, is it? Okay. Homo spiritus. Okay. We can't ask about the future. Homo spiritus. The nervous system of mankind can only handle calibrated energies up to about 600. To push it over 600 is, you've got to be really weird to do that. It's extremely arduous. Anyway, to evolve through into lovingness as the way you are in the world, 500, we calibrate that 500. Lovingness is the way you are. It's what you have become. 540 is unconditional lovingness. Not as an emotion, not as something that goes between yourself and that which is out there, but it's what you have become, you know? Like the hummingbird becomes his humming. He just does that because that's what he is, you know? So he doesn't aspire to anything, it's just what the hummingbird is. What the hummingbird does is just hum, and it sucks nectar and lugs flowers. It does that because that's what it is. That's what it is. The calibrated levels of the 500s then indicate that that's what you have become. It's a way of being in the world. It's really, it then eventually becomes the context of your life. Context of your life then becomes the energy field of lovingness itself, because you've let go all the obstacles. One of the obstacles is the mind, as we all know. Under 400s, under 200, let's see, we have this thing here. Where's our magical thing here? It works. Wow. That's the wrong one. Okay. It's always the wrong one. It's supposed to be the wrong one. When you turn the light on, it's supposed to be the wrong one. That is traditional. And of course, it's supposed to be fuzzy like that. You probably think we don't want it that way, but actually, we want it to be fuzzy. So people can say, it's fuzzy. You say, oh, it is. And then you correct it. And everybody's happy. I don't know how you correct it, but there's some way you can do that. If you turn it one way or the other, it corrects itself. Okay. All right, so below here we have really animal problems. We have animal problems. The reason we trace the evolution of consciousness is because when you see its origin, you stop feeling guilt, shame, you stop hating it, you stop fearing it. You just say, oh, that's my little animal. Good to give your little animal a name. Somebody cuts in front of you, you son of a bitch. There goes Cuckoo again. Inside of yourself is this invisible animal named Cuckoo. Cuckoo, very cuckoo. From a human viewpoint, it's cuckoo. From the cuckoo's viewpoint, you don't make much sense. You let the SOB in front of you. What's the matter with you? Aren't you a man? Let's be aggressive. Let's get over our inhibition about asserting ourselves. All right, take that, SOB. Give him the finger as you go by. Hurrah. I discovered the finger late in life. It was a joyous moment. Joyous. It happened in Sedona. I was brought up in a very dignified, traditional, high Episcopal Protestant lifestyle. We didn't use any vulgarities, crude language. And the naughtiest thing my sister and I did when we were kids, we had pianos all over the house because my family are all musicians. Everybody was gone. She sat at the top of the piano, I sat at the bottom. And she hit the keys, we were both about this big, and she went, pew, and I went, stink. Pew, stink. Man, we were so wildly bad. It was just, we used those bad words. We weren't allowed to use vulgarities. So, that was being awful. So inside ourselves, there's an animal. This animal has its own, oh yes, I was telling you about Sedona. So overt expressions of hostility, anger, vulgarities, cultured people don't do that. In the best circles, and we live in the best circles. In the East, I belong to the most elegant club, and such things were not. So here I am in Sedona, and I go out. I'm going out, what it turns out I was going in the entrance. So I was wrong to begin with. So this woman comes in and she blows her horn at me and is very, very angry. And all of a sudden, out of my animal cuckoo, I went. I did it. Transcended hundreds of years of culture, education, MDs, PhDs, master's degrees, the ultimate social club. It's so exclusive, no, the world doesn't even heard of this club. You have to actually live in that enclave to even hear the club. So anyway, it was victorious. It was a wonderful moment. I discovered that within myself. Take that. Wonderful. So you can love your cuckoo side, huh? Whoa, there he is. So I love this beast in me. He's really a lion. He's a tiger. And I love him. I love him. Here's my guilt monger. Here's the old monk beating himself with chains. And he's got a hair shirt. He kneels on his bare knees until they bleed. You ever done that? Oh, you've done it in lifetimes. How many people have done it in previous lifetimes? Oh, a lot of you. All kinds of people, we've done all those things. Here you put yourself out of decent human relationships. We've done all these things down here. So we don't have to pretend they're not there. Why would we pretend? We pretend they're not there out of shame and guilt. But that animal, without that animal in us, you wouldn't be walking around, huh? You stick here, you bleed. That's the animal bleeding, you know, right? So the way you disappear the dominance of the animal in you is you own it. Love it. I love my kitty. If I squeeze my kitty too hard, he'd scratch. No, he won't, because I took his front claws off a little something. Because he scratched me, will you? So inside of me there is a mean critter. No, actually I didn't do it out of meanness. I did it to save the cat's life because I would have thrown him across the room and he would have died of a fractured skull. So. Involuntarily. He used to do this when I'm taking a nap. And I'm always cold all the time. So I got about in the wintertime I got about 6 layers of stuff. These claws went right through, ran into it, and I picked the cat up and threw it. Son. I said, kitty, we got to do something here. I had to get my wisdom teeth taken out, and you're going to have to get your claws. I mean, it's just life, you know. So down here, our problem is emotions. And spiritually oriented people go into consternation when they find out what's hanging out in their unconscious. If you want to know what's hanging out in your unconscious, read Freud. He's right. Every negative thing you can think of is in your id. It's in there. It's in your id. And it's repressed because you have a conscience, which Freud called the superego. You feel guilty about it. I don't want to kill anybody. It's the last thing I'd ever do. Anybody who says that is a killer. Watch out. Of course the unconscious wants to kill people. When somebody cuts in front of you, you'd like to kill them. So after a while, you see, as you admit your animal by owning them, learning to love them, how do you get an animal trained? Is by loving them and training them, right? Not by locking them in a box and pretending they don't exist. So your animal is legitimate. If it wasn't God's will that you have an animal body, you wouldn't have one, right? So the nature of creation is that we're evolving through. So we have the remnants of animalness. The spiritual people call that ego. This part then has to do with negative emotions. When we start to get okay with it, we have the courage to look at it, face it, and we start going into integrity. These energies here in the low 200s have to do with attitudes, letting go positionalities, a willingness to dig in, the willingness to deal with the problems of being a human, and accepting it so that we arrive at some kind of peace about it. So at first we're dealing with animalness, right, in our evolution. We're dealing with all this animalness. Greed, of course. Greed is the runs the big corporations and hit the headlines all the time. So if you don't get over the solar plexus, you end up on TV, that the world is teed off, that you took $500 million and left all the widows out there just penniless, and the world takes a dim view of that. So if the solar plexus takes off with you. So this has to do with learning doingness. This has to do with Sanskrit called rajas, action, activity. These are the builders of the world. 200 and up builds the world. Designs the factories, sets up the commerce, runs the trains, the airplanes. And we get up to the 400s, which is the dominance of life by logic and reason, in which education becomes profoundly important. In our culture, education is probably the most important aspect that we strive for. People go without all kinds of things for education. And so they go without all kinds of things to develop this, because the 400s are far more powerful than all this. You can be mad as all hell and nothing really happens in the world. But you get up to reason and logic, you redesign the whole highway, you know, elect the officials you want, learn how to raise money and politics, and et cetera. So the 400s are very powerful. And groups such as this one here are usually quite erudite. Compared to the rest of the world, this is an extremely erudite group. I mean, this is probably 0.1% of the world's population here or less. It gets up to the 400s, and then in the 400s, becomes interested in spiritual reality and begins to study it, begins to read all the great teachers. So inspiration together with the intellect, then we find ourselves in the 400s. So the reason and logic then serves us well, increases our power enormously. You can manipulate with a computer what it would take 100,000 people a month to accomplish. In 1 second, you can accomplish a greater amount of work in 1 split second than a large percentage of a whole subcontinent. If they worked all day, every day, couldn't accomplish what you can accomplish, because symbols now become the great power. So reason and logic, which is in the 400s, the 400s are very, very powerful. They dominate the world right now. They dominate civilized society. The 400s, which then give you the intelligence to begin to see the truth of spiritual realities, the capacity to read and the value of spiritual education, now becomes, as you get to the top of the 400s, what was an asset now becomes an obstacle. The 400s got you here, and now you're stuck with it. You're stuck with reason and logic and the constructions, because the mind takes positionalities. Out of that positionality, it automatically, instantly creates duality. So the lecture today, our purpose is to see how can you transcend duality. The classic pathway, let's say Zen, and various types of Buddhism and monastic types of meditation are to transcend the mind altogether, to experience another reality directly. And the various techniques about which I've written, about which we've lectured, and which all of you have studied, certain realizations seem to potentiate that transformation, that transcending the limits of the ego, so that instead of being an obstacle, it begins to serve you. Certain things, merely to hear of them, already begin to accelerate one's progress. If we say, it's not possible for anything to cause anything else, everything is manifesting its infinite potentiality by the grace of creation, which is continuous, just that knowingness, that thought, is already powerfully transformative. Let's see what the calibration of that thought is. I don't know. As just spoken, we have permission. It's just, that is over 800, 850, 900, 920. Okay, the thought has the power at 920. That's the level of truth of the thought. To merely hold it in mind, then, and to give it a certain reverence, which we give to all truth, then empowers that thought, which then sort of goes through your mind and cuts off a whole bunch of circuits. See what I mean? You like let it loose in this syncytial nightmare we call the brain, and it runs around on its own now and begins to disconnect switches. Because if causality is not what accounts for that which is, then the mind automatically expands its context and begins to try to sense what it is. All that we look at then is content. As you mature spiritually, you look less and less at content and look more and more at context. One begins to sense the field in which that thought is occurring. Again, you see, as you expand context, the context itself is limited by certain definitions. And you start letting go of the definitions. Eventually, context becomes the infinite presence out of which the entire universe manifests. The unmanifest, manifesting itself as the manifest, which is the source of creation, in which we experience existence. The only possible source of existence is divinity itself. And out of this awareness, and moving up into the heart, where you begin to see the beauty of all that exists, because you stop thinking about it. When you stop thinking about it, you see the beauty of all that exists. So through the doorway of beauty and the letting go of thinkingness, because you're branching out your awareness to the field instead of the content of the field, one experiences the presence of divinity, which manifests itself as existence. There is nothing has the power to bring about existence from nothingness. Huh? Once you take away causality as an excuse, a rationalization, Causality is the ego's last hold. The Buddha defined it as the law of dependent causation or something. And that law is at 996. What we're talking about today calibrates at 998. Nothing is causing anything. Everything is being continuously sourced by a continuous presence, which gives it the power to manifest its infinite potentiality as that which it is. So the hummingbird, as his wings go down, does not cause the next thing of his wings going up, which does not cause the next thing of his wings going up. The source of this wing movement is exactly the source of this wing movement, is exactly the source. There's a continuous source. And what the source does is empower the potentiality to become manifest as existence, which we then witness as life. Is that clear? Of course it's clear. Everybody here gets it and understands it. Some people don't realize that they understand it, that's all. And I want to remove that obstacle. Everybody here knows that, or you couldn't exist. How could you exist unless you came into existence? I mean, it's a stupid question, isn't it? The source of existence, obviously, is how come you exist. Yeah. It's kindergarten thinking and too much for advanced intellectual people like us to get. Yeah, the only way you can be here is because you are here. Oh, wow. Let's see if that's a good one, Susie. Let's see. That is over 998. Okay, so that is what they need to know. All right, so that knowingness is present within you. Latent, but after this morning, no longer latent. It's vibrating in everybody's aura right now. So that knowingness is there forever. Well, I'll let you take care of this morning's lecture, folks. Bye. The pathway of duality, then, is called no mind. No mind. In this experience which occurred within, it wasn't called no mind because there was no mind to call it no mind. I learned about no mind many years later. Because to reacquire mind is a project. It is not easy. And most people who don't have any mind left leave it that way, and we don't hear from them again. Which is frankly the best advice, I think. The best thing to do when you go into a bliss state and realize that love, God, oneness, and that which you are one and you're immobilized in that state, resist the temptation to reactivate the body. That is my advice. However, you may have had a prior karmic commitment about it, but which may pull you back in. But so the condition of no mind. Somebody was asking me this week. Yes, I want to answer some of the questions that came up in the office this week. Somebody said, what did he say about no mind? I can't remember what he said about no mind. Oh, yes. It was a funny question. If it's the silence that teaches, then how can you teach silence when you're talking? Oh, yes. This has to do with an interview with Ramana Maharshi. Maharshi, in response to a question, had said that the teaching happens as a matter of silence. So this person wanted to know how that could be. It's because the silence is always present. The talkingness does not eliminate the silence, it distracts you from it. But the silence of the energy of the field itself transmits. Everyone within this room is sharing that. We're all sharing it with each other because we're all just one. Yeah. And so the oneness of that knowingness is sufficient. So while Ramana Maharshi is chattering to you about something because he's got to amuse this visitor, because visitors are very verbal, he's got to say something to this guy. He came all the way from Cleveland to see him. So Ramana looks at him and he's busy eating his porridge on his palm leaf or something. And that was the transmission. Then the seeker says, blah, 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 blah. And Ramana says, yeah, yeah, yeah. So the seeker goes away feeling happy. He said this, Ramana said that, but that had nothing to do with what happened, huh? Let's see. So no mind then is silent. No mind is really nothing but the realization of the ultimate context of one's own existence. So the content then is your existence. We said that there's content. Meaning comes out of content, but only within a context. So then let's take as a proposition for the content your own existence. And what is the ultimate context of your own existence? Huh? I don't agree with Ramana Maharshi came up in his questions in the office. I saw some visitors this week. Because of his instruction to ask always continuously as a continuous contemplation, who am I? I don't agree with who am I. Because who makes you look for a pronoun, looks for you see, it's already a limitation. A who is a limitation. So you're looking for a who, you know. And there ain't any who. There ain't no who there. And you're looking for a not who. You're looking for a not who. If you find a who, that ain't it. Oh. You're looking for a condition, a what? The sense of self within one, within. Is a whatness, it's an isness, it's a conditionness, and it's also the most powerful sense of I that can exist. It is I, but beyond the pronoun I. So I'm always afraid of people say, who am I? They're looking for a pronoun, a self-definition of I, and it's going to take them right back into the ego's definition of who you think you are. The infinite stillness behind whatever sounds we hear in the room is yourself. Without the infinite stillness of yourself, you wouldn't be able to hear anything. Without the infinite context of non-form, you would not be able to experience form. Because of the voidness of the presence, one experiences form, experiences existence, is aware of what the mind is up to. So we don't want to be scared of mind. We'll handle mind the same we did the animal. We love mind. Not our enemy. It took evolution billions of years to develop this incredible thing here, which I now, because I want to realize the presence of God, now becomes an obstacle. Got all the way to Mars, and now how do you get off the place? Here we are, folks. Without this, you'd never get to Mars. What do you do once you get to Mars? You're trying to figure out how to get off Mars. That's what you do. We've got enough gas left, Susie. I don't think we can get off this place. All right, so whether a thing is a deterrent or a tool, whether it's an asset or a curse, is all dependent on how you look at it. If you love all this stuff here, you have a good time with it. I had a whale of a good time giving that lady the finger. I mean, it was wonderful. I just found that beast in me, and he just, wow. I can be completely detached, you know, this morning. The cat's missing. Release on the cat. Lots of cats. Another one come along. Orange cats are a dime a dozen. Well, one time we did that, I think, in front of the audience. We'll just do it again. Take care of the kitty. Mm-hmm. We have permission to ask about the orange kitty. There's only one orange kitty in reality. There's only one orange kitty. And its attractor field exists within the animal realm. And it manifests serially as thousands, millions of orange kitties. But it's always the same orange kitty. Same orange kitty, just back in the same body. Same, you notice all orange kitties have the same nature. They're all the same. So anyway, I let go of orange kitty, and so that was here, see? The willingness to do that and accepting that maybe kitty is gone. And reason tells me there's going to be a lot of kitties. And I love that kitty, and I would love the next kitty. And the realization of all the truth of this brings me joyfulness and peace. And in that joyfulness and peace, I said, Holy Spirit, we ask for a miracle. And Brock said, your kitty's down here. So there you are. You see, you go through the hole all the way down, you know, all the way through the whole thing. So you transcend the limitation of content by energizing your awareness of context. Context. Out of the context, energizing the context, arises the miraculous. The kitty appears, and I walked up to the bathroom door, and she opened the door, and she said, there's kitty. So in the sequential world of perception then, that was the moment of crying with happiness, right? Everything was happy. If you hold in mind, kitty is lost, now you're giving power to kitty is lost. You understand? No, kitty's not lost. Kitty always returns home. And if kitty doesn't return home in this physicality, orange kitty will get impatient on the other side and energize another orange body and going to be right back. And when you hear it purring, it's going to be the same kitty. Let's see if that's so. We have permission to resist. It is the same kitty, resist. It is the same kitty, I told you that. Somebody there had a doubt. Now you made me go do this. And of course we've done the lovingness of the kitty's purr. Everybody's seen that. Anybody not seen the calibration of the kitty purr? We know kitty purr. We'll just do it for those who have never seen it. Kitty's purr is over 480, 490, 500, 502. Kitty's purr is 500. Isn't that miraculous? In a world where they strip search old ladies and take a baton and whack on their steel hip replacement, did cats have a heart at 500? Would Orange Kitty do that to her? No. Orange Kitty wouldn't make a poor old lady strip search and bang a baton against her steel hip to make sure that's not a bomb in there. By God, there's a good plan. Hey there, Bin Laden. Anybody know how to get Bin Laden on the internet? Put bombs in old ladies' steel pins in their hips. They blow up, and so does the whole ship. You kill all those Americans. For God. Oh, boy. Insanity. So we don't have to get depressed about the human condition, because this morning we got, this is just a phase. This is you know, we're like Cro-Magnon man, we're like Piltdown man, we're like, they all got such great names. Australopithecus erectus or something. Is that right? Australopithecus. Australopithecus. Anyway, we're the current expression of where this line of evolution is going. So we can take that then. Instead of feeling sorry for ourselves, okay, we could accept that, be willing to serve. In a way then, as a species, we are serving God in being that link in the evolution of consciousness. No, we're not the link, we're the expression of the link. The evolution of consciousness goes on in the non-physical domain and then sporadically expresses in the physical. That's why evolution is sporadic. See, evolution, the monkey doesn't get smarter and smarter, become a Cro-Magnon man and a PhD at NAU, you know? No, he gets off the bus here, and then the main line, he can go to the next bus, so we come off like this. So here we are. Homo hystericus. Homo absurditus. Homo ludicrous. Homo patheticus. Homo funniness. Hysterical. I think humans are funny. Anyway, you get up through here, you see? So our job then, so as we evolve our consciousness, we're doing it for all that follow us. It wasn't for Neanderthal man, maybe we wouldn't be here. I don't know, I never asked that. Let's see. Do we have permission to ask that, Resist? They served as a link in our own evolution. So did Cro-Magnon man, all these people, all those ones behind. And we serve in the same sequence. See, we are serving, just like Neanderthal man served. And he calibrated around 70 or something like that, I think, 70. Cro-Magnon man, Piltdown man, the one in Germany, is that Piltdown man? Who's from Germany? Neanderthal. Neanderthal man, yeah, okay. All right, so it's like we're part of an evolution then, and then by willingness and grace, we accept our role in this evolution of consciousness. So we don't have to be resentful or angry. Let's say we serve God then by merely being a human being. Huh? Let's see if that's so. We can ask that and resist. We serve God merely by living out the life of a human being to the best of our potentiality. Resist. Oh-ho. So there goes a lot of guilt, right? The reason I gave her the finger, God, is I was trying to evolve my consciousness to overcome my fear of being assertive, overcome my Protestant inhibited background. We have angelic nature on one side and that animal on the other side. And here we're balanced then between the sort of the evolution of Homo spiritus. So we are a signal documentation of evolution at this point. So we are part of the soon to erupt Homo spiritus. Yeah, that's who we are. If we weren't Homo spiritus, nobody would be in this room. Yeah, we are Homo spiritus. That's a lot different than Cro-Magnon man. A lot different than lots of people who are still on the planet. They should get off, shouldn't they? So on the planet, then, we have a whole mix from the very bottom. We have some humans that are calibrate lower than animals. Lots of them. They hit the headlines every night. Serial killers, butcher up little children, et cetera, et cetera. They always claim they're innocent, too. That's one mark of guilt. They always say they're innocent. The DNA is all over the wall, all over the kid, all over the car, and his fingerprints are everywhere. I'm innocent. Oh, well. So So on the planet at this time, then, we have the whole galaxy of evolution all the way from the most horrendous to the most beatific, all the way to Buddha, Jesus Christ, Krishna, all the great saints, Mother Teresa, Ramana Maharshi, all the names that we revere because they document where consciousness has evolved, what they represent, what does Mother Teresa represent? We'll get to her next talk. She'll have to wait till next time. She represents unconditional love, the heart at 700, wow. Capacity, unconditional love. All right, so as consciousness evolves into the higher energies of love, a lot that the ego was involved in when it was when ego's dominated from down here, its content, what you're laying in bed at night thinking about, is totally different than when you put it in the context of lovingness. In lovingness, now, if you're still annoyed with somebody, you try to see it differently because dislike, hatred, regret, resentments are no longer pleasant, they're painful. They're like a splinter. And when you're angry, you don't mind it, you know, when you're angry. When you're in a lower energy field, that which is non-integrous doesn't bother you. They're all cutthroats. That lifetime I've told you about, they're all cutthroats. Good fellows. Ask them to kill somebody, kill it just like that. I mean, he was a swell guy. No question about it. As you evolve in consciousness, though, now you can't tolerate the non-integrous anymore. Your old pirate shipmates are no longer welcome in your life, you know? They try to come back in your life and you say, well, my life is taken a different way, you know what I mean? I just don't feel like going out and killing and raping anymore. What's happened to old Dave, man? You lost your spirit, boy. I thought we were going to hit some waterfront dive and get into a brawl, man, and the broads and, you know, knock a few teeth in, you know. They used to do that, I mean, even in this lifetime, World War II, you know, I was on a minesweep. The biggest fun was you'd hit shore, you'd hit the bars, and they called me Shorty. In those days, people weren't into political correctness. If you're short, they called you Shorty. If you're chunky, they called you Fatso. If you were black, they called you Black. Nobody cared about it. It was part of who we loved each other for that. But Polak was a Polak. He loved being a Polak. A WOP. I mean, we all just were who we were with each other. You know, now that's not right. But what they liked to do was go ashore and drink up a storm and start a brawl. I just wasn't into brawling, you know what I mean? Even at that point in my life, I was not into brawling. And but you also have to have a macho image, so you can't look like you're a coward. So how do you get out of brawling? Well, if you're not a very good brawler, they say, Shorty, you stand over there, and then pop, pop, pop. Wop, wop, wop. That's what they did, you know. Stand out of the way. Anyway, that's not exactly what you're into. And we've said before, if you take a waterfront dive, you clean it up, new owner puts in new carpets, puts new drapes, puts new lighting in, paints the whole place, makes a nice new sign. He opens up a month later, none of the old crowd goes there anymore. You've changed the energy. You've changed the energy field. So as we become more integrous then, that which is less than integrous, we can no longer tolerate. There's a certain field where you get, there's a certain level of lovingness here. There's a certain level of lovingness here where you can't see anything except innocence and lovingness. You can only see people as being innocent and loving. And you loan your money to crooks. You loan your car to car thieves. Your analyst says you're in denial about the negatives of life. And you think to yourself, what negatives? You know what I mean? I don't know what this guy is talking about. You say, well, he's probably of a lower consciousness. Oh, he sees negative things in people. Well, God bless him. Dear Lord, please help this man's spirit so he sees the pure innocence of all that exists. Right. Well, you're looking at the self, but your physicality is in a physicality in which you can get hit by the bus. So the error is to mix levels, I told you when I talked about the Course in Miracles, trust your brother, I have my doubts about that one. It cost me a couple hundred thousand, as a matter of fact. And so I have a question about that particular lesson. Well, that's the rest of my girlfriend. We become less and less able to tolerate the non-integrous. Now, sometimes the non-integrous are relatives or somebody that you have an investment with, etc. And now you've got to transcend the attachment to that, you know? Why? Because it's not that the non-integrous themselves are dangerous to your life. It's very unlikely they will be. I mean, so they take away all your money, you know, in the space I was in, I couldn't care less. You want all the money? Take it. Yeah. I used to put a bag of money by my front door, and I said, if he doesn't have money, there's some. Help yourself. So it wasn't that. It's if something is non-integrous in your life, what happens is it's a doorway through which the energies of that which is non-integrous now have a play with your life. So it's more that you want to plug up the hole, the leak. It's that they're a leak, and through them come all kinds of things. Your brakes fail. Battery goes dead. The ceiling begins to leak. You wonder, where the hell is all this coming from? It's the energy field then. So, you know, Jesus said to avoid that. Don't oppose it. Pray for it. People that are evolved see the innocence behind it. You can see the innocence behind it and still decline it. So that is the balance. So it's a matter of balance. It's a matter of the third eye of the Buddhic body, really, to see that is non-integrous. At the same time, it is innocent. At the same time, you can't allow it to walk around the house. You can love the cobra for its intrinsic beauty for that which it is, but you can't really let him run around the house. Why? Because you're going to sit in your chair someday and forget the cobra is there and goodbye, there you go. My mind is also a comedian. It's always thinking of funny things. And I have to stem that. A cobra bite in the tail is always fatal, you know. The leg, it's okay, but in the cobra bite there is goodbye. So you can't have a cobra in the house because you might sit on it. So that would be an unwanted result. So the non-integrous brings into your life the unwanted result. And it does it innocently by nature of its own energy of which it is unaware. It isn't that it's hateful, vicious, destructive. It's just that this dog has fleas. I love Rover, but he's got fleas, folks. And when you get fleas in the house, anybody ever get dog fleas in the house? Oh boy, it is something getting them out. One day I had a cat that got into the fleas. And it was like 6 months of fighting fleas. It was, you wouldn't guess how I finally found him. Anyway, the fleas had gotten into the rug of the car. So the house is sprayed and exterminated, and 2 weeks later, there's fleas in the house. Where the hell did they come from? They're in the rug of the car. See, once it gets in, it's like fleas. The way I found out, anyway, I found the last flea in the house. I found out where he was. So in the evolution of our consciousness, we go through really, I think, quite difficult and trying periods. Even lovingness itself, you see, has a downside. When you see everyone is innocent and loving, one day your car is missing from the parking lot. Now, at that level, it doesn't really matter. In that state of consciousness, cars come, cars go, big deal. In the physical domain, insurance will pay for it. I mean, it's a nothing, really. It's a nuisance. You got to rent a car and all that. But you're failing to see the meaning of it, that you allowed that opportunity to be there by allowing something in your life that you really don't need to be there. It isn't that you can't live it through. It isn't that you can't overcome it. Of course you can. Insurance will pay you. You'll get another car. So what do you lose? You lose time and energy. You've lost time and energy. And you've been distracted from something that might have been more beneficial to the world and society and yourself. So we're talking about sort of subtle things because people are seriously committed, you know, have really lots of strange experiences. And I think sharing them with each other is very beneficial. And the books I've written have got sort of extremely wide distribution. We get all kinds of letters and phone calls and emails, and I mean, it's a torrent of communications. And a lot of them include, you might say, oddities of human behavior. Things you don't read about, you don't see them in the movies, you don't see them on television. But people have subjective, very different kinds of experiences. And, in 50 years of psychiatry, I've heard everything. But since I wrote this book and I start getting mail from out in the world there's more things that I never even heard about as a psychiatrist, I'll tell you. Strange dislocations between spirit and body, strange alterations in consciousness. People they fall into the so-called cities for a while. And the miraculous begins to happen all over the place. And they find their consciousness can affect electronic equipment, and there's all kinds of strange things, and they don't know what to make of it. I always tell them, it's best not to mention this to anybody, frankly. Read up on the cities, it's there in the Sanskrit literature, it's classic, but I really wouldn't confide it in other people. And when I went through that period, frankly, I didn't. Or the few times I did, I wished I hadn't. And besides, people, the ordinary people that are around you won't even see what you're seeing anyway, so because you're living on a different level, vibrational level of consciousness, you might say, and they don't even witness what you witness. And the lady gets up and walks away without her cane. You say, you see that? She said, they say, well, she didn't have a cane before. The cane's sitting there. So what can you say about such thing? Nothing. A lot of these phenomena, so that's one positive reason for becoming associated with other people who are spiritually committed. In the old days, classically, we left the world, we joined a spiritual community, and such things were well known, documented, they've been known for centuries. Now we tend to be more isolated from each other. We meditate by ourselves, although we attend meetings and all, there isn't that constant interchange of communication. So we need each other's support in ways that are not so easily obtained in today's world. Although I think, the internet, which I don't understand at all, but there are like websites where people talk to each other about these things, so there is that need for communication, these phenomena in your life. Many things are not comprehensible until they're recontextualized. So when we say, where are we in the evolution of consciousness, and we pick out where we are, and we see that we're a part of an evolving species, and in probably 10 million years or less than that, we're going to be replaced by something. For one thing, we'll have to have a better nervous system, because this human nervous system is only scheduled to go up to 600. At 600, the state is one of bliss. As you go up into higher and higher lovingness, these stages here, you can't stop crying. Everything, two people look at each other, a mother looks at her child, and instantly you break out in tears. It's just, you can't. Or music. I've got some music. We hear this tape we play, and at the end of the one that Brock at the bio back at the end of that tape put some beautiful music, which I can't handle, because the minute that music starts, I wouldn't be able to lecture. You instantly break out into tears, because in beauty and the incredible sense of the presence becomes overwhelming, and it wipes out all functioning in the world. And therefore, spiritual communities serve a very, very valuable service, because within that community, it's safe to share. I'm talking about a legitimate spiritual community, not some of the sort of bizarre encampments that occur along the roadside someplace, but those which, if you calibrate them, are integrous. That state of lovingness, then, becomes the new context in which that lovingness then becomes the context in which content now takes on a different coloration. So you could look at context almost like colored lights of different intensity which surround that which you're looking at, and how those lights are focused and their intensity totally changes how you see it, because it's a holographic universe, and what you see is the product of the position from which you're seeing it, which is why quantum mechanics offers the inlet that road from the logical Newtonian paradigm of reality to the more powerful spiritual reality. No mind is very talkative this morning. I don't know where he got all that. Came out of nowhere. I said, how can you talk with no mind if you've got no mind? No, these people, you got to talk to them in language that requires a mind. Instantly, mind appeared right out of nowhere. So it's time for a break. Yeah, from the pathway of negation, we might end up at the void and say, there's nobody here, there's nobody to answer, and therefore there's no questions. All right, so he's looking for the seat. Here it is. All right. We have a lot of questions, and I try to put them into groups, baskets, so that we can answer many questions at the same time just by comprehension and understanding. As we evolve spiritually, we're constantly presented with ambiguities. One way to see your way out of an ambiguity is to ask if you're mixing levels. Are you mixing levels? Things are true within a certain context. In another context, they're no longer valid, you understand? Jesus said, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar, and to God that which is God. So in other words, don't mix the levels. Don't think you can walk around without paying your taxes. Because they'll put you away. Of course, prison is a good place to meditate, and you can become enlightened in jail. And some people pull that one on themselves. You know, the people over centuries have gotten enlightened in prison. And I can't get away from this world, God. You've just been arrested. You got 10 years in solitary. There you got it. Monastery for one. I told you, when I lived in a monastery for one, and the body disappeared. I walked into a wall, and then I walked past a mirror. There was somebody in the house. I walked past the mirror, and there's somebody in the house, for Christ's sake. Who is that? Oh my God, it's myself. Oh my. What a surprise. So the validity of calibration, of kinesiology, we'll answer questions about kinesiology. I'm not a kinesiologist, and people who want all kinds of detailed questions about kinesiology are better to correspond. There's a kinesiology website full of all kinds of experts with all kinds of references. If you can't do it yourself, find somebody that can. There's people around that are interested in this kind of thing. There's a lot of holistic practitioners that are very good at it, teach you how. So I'm not an expert in kinesiology. And I explained that Galileo was not an expert in making telescopes, you know. You got a telescope maker, you got this telescope, everybody's looking in everybody's backyard with telescopes, and he went up this way, and that's sort of where I'm at. I'm not into making telescopes, and I get all kinds of technical questions about kinesiology, which I really am not able to answer. We have found that it's a technique available to people who themselves are integrists. Integrity means calibrated 200 or over. There's an enormous amount of power given to you to be able to use kinesiology to find out things. There's an enormous jump in power, and that power is just not given to people who would misuse it. So one reason that I delayed publishing Power versus Force is I worried about that. I thought, you know, everybody's going to be using it to invent better atomic bombs and kill each other better, you know? I can picture Bin Laden testing kinesiology. Should we hit the World Trade Center? Yeah, all right. So I worried about it. And anyway, it later came to me that it can only be used by integrous people for integrous ends. So the intention of the question itself has to be integrous. And you can change a non-integrous question into an integrous one if you recontextualize it from a different context. And the classic one is, say, in the interest of the good of all of life, you know, in the interest of the good and the goodness of all of life for everyone, I have permission to ask this question. So then you ask, I have permission to ask this question. And even though we've done it hundreds of thousands of times, as you've seen during some of these classes, we occasionally get a no. And we don't have time to check out the reason for the no at the moment. But it's something you put aside and you say, that's something we'll have to investigate later. So because 85% of the population is below 200, when I wrote Power versus Force, I was naive about that. I thought, wow, everybody can do kinesiology. Then I found out later, no, you can only do it if you're over 200. Then I looked at the calibrated scale of consciousness and I realized that only, that means 15% of the population can do it. Of that 15%, is it 10% that have something wrong with their chi energy? Let's ask. Right now, approximately 15% of the population can use it. Of that 15%, 10% have some problem with their chi energy. That is correct. You know, even people who are integrous, not everybody's adept at it. So it's only one way of ascertaining truth. Don't forget, kinesiology is really not, you know, it's really a research technique. You don't need it to reach enlightenment. The Buddha didn't know kinesiology. And all the great saints that ever lived, Mother Teresa never heard of it, see? And at the time I corresponded with Mother Teresa, Jesus Christ was under attack. I think the front cover of Time, or was Jesus Christ, did he ever really live? Was he a schizophrenic, homosexual, you know what I mean? All this kind of stuff that periodically surfaces. And so the reality of the divinity of Jesus Christ was under attack, you know. Those things come up periodically. So I just thought Mother Teresa would be interested in that there's a scientific way of validating the divinity of Christ as part of armamentarium of the knowingness of the religious community. So anyway, it's really a research tool. Occasionally, it would be very useful in your life, but it's not as useful as you may think it is. It's because understanding comes out of the advancement of one's own consciousness. We use it very often because we're answering questions from other people or because we're investigating new areas. You know, in the writings we do and in the videotapes and all, you know, we're looking into things that mankind has never had access to, never had access to. It's like, you know, x-rays or the electron microscope. This whole areas of life that there was no way of investigating. And now we have ways of investigating it. And of course, we're always coming up with questions ourselves. So one, the answer to one question, you know, leads to the next. And there, of course, is that technique of self-testing, which some people are also good at. So that's all I can say about kinesiology. It's a thing in itself. Now we have some specific questions about illnesses. Illnesses seem to be karmic consequences. They take a very specific form. They have a very specific duration. Most illnesses are cyclic in nature. If the illness did not exist before and you have it now, it's obviously not permanent. So if it's cycled in, it can also cycle out. So what I tell patients in the office, no matter what ails you, if it's cycled into your life, it can also cycle out. As you evolve in consciousness, it doesn't matter whether it cycles in or out. It doesn't matter anymore. People do the Course of Miracles in order to recover from certain illnesses. And I tell them, if you're successful with the Course of Miracles, you won't care whether the illness leaves or not, because you transcend it. And you live well, you know, you learn how to live with various physical things. And they're because you don't focus on them, they're irrelevant. I've got, you know, right now, two or three things that if I think about it, oh yes. And I had to do an exercise to get off the rug this morning because my back went out from shoveling the other day. Various trivia like that, but it's all trivia. And I'm sure everything like that serves multiple purposes. I like the lesson in the Course in Miracles. It says you're only subject to what you hold in mind. It doesn't mean you're going to be able to discover consciously what you're holding in mind. Or from what lifetime. But it is an avenue approaching which offers some hope for relief. And in my own life, it really worked quite well. It says, when you're doing kinesiology, are you looking without, within, or what? I'm not looking anywhere. So I'll just explain kinesiology one last time. The next person who asks about it is going to really get it. Okay, what I'm holding in mind is true, is it? Thank you. Now, she did not hear what I'm holding in mind. So that answers the question. Isn't what the test subject believes going to influence your answer? The answer is no. I didn't tell her what it is. I said, is this audience over 431? Yes, it is. And you can use it with children. You can put Bin Laden's. I love Bin Laden. We used to use Hitler all the time, but he went and got out of here. Now we got a new one, Bin is, when you want a bad example, you trot him out, you know what I mean? If he gets killed off, we'll have to find a new evil one, you know? Anyway, Bin Laden in the service. His picture in a manila envelope held over a child's solar plexus will make the child go weak. So that answers what you're holding in mind is going to influence the result. Those are questions that first come up when you first learn kinesiology. The first class I ever went to that came up, of course, and it's been looked at and answered by thousands and thousands of practitioners over many years. And the answer is always the same. No, it's the reaction of consciousness itself to the presence of truth. And a no answer is not a no. It's that truth is not present. So it's not yes versus no, it's yes versus not yes. Otherwise we get into the polarity of the opposites. Truth is either present or it is not present. The electric is either on or not on. There is no condition of electricity called offness. So we're not testing onness versus offness. Onness is either present or not present. Light bulb goes on, so is that clear? Otherwise we get into the dualities of, you know, good versus bad and all the rest of that. This next question is I'll put it out generically. How can our actions bring about changes in the world if it's not via the mechanism of cause? How do actions have consequences? We see that actions, that one action has followed another. So from a strictly scientific viewpoint, we could say they were sequential. Sequential to what? Sequential to observation. You can't say in of themselves sequential, because that's just a concept that you're rejecting. If certain conditions prevail, then we have noticed throughout time a certain sequence of perceptions. From a strictly ultra-scientific viewpoint, that's all you can say about it. I hear a ring in this, getting feedback. To be strictly truthful, all you can ever say is what you observe, what appears to be. Because to know that something is happening there, the only way you'd know it is you'd have to be it. You'd have to be it. That is a subtle point, of course, in the jump into quantum mechanics, is there's observables. And our language is catching up, and I'm very pleased with it. The word perceived is now entering our language. A perceived this, a perceived that. That leaves room for the subjectivity. So it's closer to reality, the perceived event, the perceived witness, perceived event. That means you've introduced back into a personless, dead world, subjectivity. Because it is only subjectivity that has any reality to it. Observables all depend on the observer and the point of observation and the definitions and symbols, and it is far removed from the actuality itself. So when we say a perceived event, that is certainly closer to reality. It's choice to let that which is non-integrous go from one's life. In many people's spiritual evolution, this is a crucial area. And we see many people in a town like Sedona, for instance, who leave everything and everyone and all their titles and buildings and money and relationships and everything, and give up everything for God. And then drive a bus to make ends meet, you know. So we see the willingness to sacrifice everything for God. If that everything, if whatever it is non-integrous, it has to go sooner or later. It has to go. And it's sort of a test. The willingness to surrender everything to God, to step over one's own children on every level, to walk away from that which is non-integrous. One may have to walk away from one's own child, surrender that to God. Well, God, he's your problem now. You go to Al-Anon and learn that one. That's his problem, and I'm going to live my life. Okay. It isn't that you plug the leak, that you make it, you make a choice, and you don't do it out of a make wrong. See, because at the same time you're seeing innocence. The reason we're talking about this is because spiritual people, as they evolve, become very, they have big areas of naivete. The devotee, the initiate, is a long way from the spiritual master. A lot of gray hairs to go through before you go from initiate to master. So there is a period of naivete, and it comes when you see the innocence and lovability of all things. So it's really a vulnerability. What happened to our scale? Somebody stole our scale. Check everybody at the door. Anyway. It's a risk up here. When you get into the lovingness, you can only see the innocence and lovableness and beauty of all that exists. And you think the guy who just stole your car is great. He looks just like my dad, you know what I mean? Sweet old man. And he just walked off with the keys to your car. So there is that gap. And so what you see is the innocence of all beings, which you really need to see to transcend to an enlightened state. Intrinsically, all that lives is its own nature is innocent. It does what it's programmed to do. Some of the behaviors are programmed by evolution itself, by the very function of the brain itself. The lion chases its lunch and eats it. Doesn't kill anything, understand? It's innocent in what it does. It's just being a lion. If you're a lion, rabbits look nummy. And we cited at the last lecture that lady that had the lifetime lion, and they wrote a book about her and a movie and all. In the end, the lion ate her because he loved her. We checked that out, right? He didn't kill her because he hated her. He loved her so much, he just, I could eat you up, and he did. Enjoyed every bite. Oh, man. All right, so even though you love the lion and you see its intrinsic innocence, it can eat you. And in the end, if you're not aware, it can eat you. So I see these trainers, you know, put their head in the mouth of an alligator for the camera, and they put their head in the mouth of the lion, and you know it's only a matter of time before his head's going to get eaten off. I know the alligator's going to bite his head off one day. I just know it. Why? Because an alligator is an alligator. Don't you get it? He's not going to become